call this meeting of the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee to order for Thursday, March 21st. And Representative Schultz, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
No, Mr. Chair. I defer to Representative Jordan.
Representative Jordan, did you get a chance?
Mr. Chair, I did get a chance to look at the minutes, and I would move that the committee approve the minutes for March 19th.
The motion is to approve the minutes for March 19th, 2024. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. Members, we have four bills on the agenda today, and so we'll start with the first bill here, and hopefully we can get through them and be kind to our fellow members of the House. And Representative Coulter, I will make a motion to move House File 4994 to be re-referred to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a DE3. If someone would be willing to move that.
And I will move the DE amendment to put the bill in the form the author wants. All in favor of the DE amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is approved. Explain your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Our state and communities need housing. They need economic development. And we all certainly know that local governments have significant facilities needs. But addressing those needs should not come at the cost of workers' lives and livelihoods. I think we all acknowledge that there are times when public support of economic development is a good thing. And certainly there is, I think, broad recognition of the need for public investment in addressing the affordable housing crisis that we face. The bill before you today addresses three particular forms of public support for development and construction. Tax increment financing, or TIF, low-income housing tax credits, and sales tax exemptions on public projects. All of these tools provide critical public support on projects that very often would not happen without them. But we also know that funding, particularly provided by TIF and LIHTC, can be used by developers who abuse and exploit their workers. A recent study shows that since 2016, $31 million of LIHTC funding went to problem contractors, and another $53 million in TIF funding did. In other words, over $80 million public dollars that we know of, I should say, have gone to developers who have engaged in wage theft and other exploitative practices. TIF in particular, and I will try not to get too far in the weeds on TIF, can be very problematic because TIF districts are often created at the local level, where oversight is uneven at best. And because TIF leverages expected increases in property taxes, there's no direct immediate cost to taxpayers. House File 4994, as amended, adds both TIF and LIHTC to the list of forms of financial assistance that fall under our state's existing prevailing wage requirements and would add projects owned by cities, counties, and school districts that receive certain sales tax exemptions to those that require prevailing wage as well. Doing so will add transparency on the part of developers and give the state of Minnesota the tools necessary to hold them accountable for exploitation and abuse. Most importantly, perhaps, it will protect the integrity of public investment. I'm happy to take any questions. Are we to go to testifiers?
And I have testifiers listed here. The first person on my list is Jake Schweitzer. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and then proceed with your testimony. And the next person is Joe Boucher. So go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Jake Schweitzer, and I am the executive director of North Star Policy Action. We're a think tank that promotes data-driven solutions to help working Minnesotans thrive. And I'm here to speak in favor of House File 4994. I can be brief. This committee has already heard much of this testimony in regards to another bill that focused more on the low-income housing tax credit. But just to reiterate our findings, in November, North Star Policy Action released our report called Subsidizing Abuse. This report named contractors that have been charged with or faced allegations of exploitation, according to interviews with workers and industry experts. We identified housing developments that have received funding from LIHTC, low-income housing tax credits, or TIF, tax increment financing, and are employing the problem contractors that we named. We found that since 2016, workers on 25 projects that received approximately $31 million in LIHTC funding were at risk of exploitation by problem contractors. and since 2018, workers on 14 projects that received approximately $53 million in TIF subsidies were also at risk. In total, over $84 million in taxpayer subsidies have gone to projects employing contractors with proven or alleged labor violations. That's why this bill is so important. Expanding prevailing wage requirements to TIF projects will protect workers on those job sites and across the entire industry from artificially depressed wages. So I'd like to thank Representative Coulter for his leadership on this issue, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Mr. Boucher. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Beshe. I'm here on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comment on House File 4994. ABC is a trade association made up of 240 commercial and industrial contractors and their 20,000 plus employees. These men and women are part of the 75% of workers in the construction industry that choose to be merit shop craft professionals. Our members and their highly skilled craft professionals take pride in their work and get the job done regardless of project requirements. ABC is fundamentally opposed to various prevailing wage mandates that are included in this bill as amended by the Delete Everything Amendment. These mandates will limit competition, increase the cost of construction, and result in overall higher project costs, which in some cases will be carried by local taxpayers. These increased costs will be imposed without any increase in quality or value and no guarantee that the work will be done by local contractors. There are numerous studies that show that prevailing wage mandates increase costs. For example, research shows that West Virginia's prevailing wage mandate, which was repealed in 2016, inflated the cost of public school construction by at least 7%. Another study of New York's prevailing wage mandate found that the prevailing wage inflated the cost of publicly funded construction projects by between 13% and 25%. More important than any study, however, is the actual experience of the local contractors who perform the work. Our local Minnesota contractor members have reported increased costs due to prevailing wage mandates, oftentimes with a cost increase of at least 10 to 15%. This cost difference can even be greater in greater Minnesota. In fact, just this last year, local ABC contractors were awarded a contract to perform work for a school district in southwestern Minnesota. The project was initially bid with the prevailing wage requirement, but after seeing the inflated costs driven by this mandate, the school district rebid the project at market-based wages. It was completed on time, on budget, and built by hardworking local merit shop craft professionals. Finally, I just have to say that any insinuation that the absence of prevailing wage leads to lower labor standards or lower quality work are without merit. Such insinuations are an insult to both local contractors who do great work in their communities, as well as the thousands of craft professionals who proudly perform high quality work day after day, regardless of whether prevailing wage is paid. Rather than enact policies that increase costs and make it more difficult for high quality contractors to compete, state should be encouraging policies that promote fair and open competition in the construction industry and obtain the best value for taxpayers. We respectfully request a no vote on House File 4994, and I thank you all for the opportunity to provide comment.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience that needs to speak on this bill? If not, I'll open up for questions. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Coulter on this bill. I realize we have some new language here, and just wanted to kind of hone in a little bit on the report. Mr. Schweitzer, is there any chance that you have a copy of this report that you referenced to your testifier for each of the committee members?
Welcome back, Mr. Schweitzer.
Thank you, Chair. I apologize that wasn't included in your packet. I have, I believe, one copy of the report in my bag that I could provide to you. Otherwise, I'd be happy to follow up with the members of this committee with a link to an online link to the report, if that would be helpful.
Representative Schultz.
Yes, please, and thank you. And then same question, actually, for Representative Coulter. You referenced a report as well that said that that there has been abuse on projects totaling $80 million. Do you also have that report?
Representative Coulter.
Again, I do, but I, again, only have one copy. So unless you're all prepared to crowd around the table, I think it would just be best perhaps to distribute to the committee afterward.
Okay.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it the same report?
Yes.
Okay. That's helpful for us all. Certainly, given the amount of testimony and you, Ms., to the author, that certainly would have been helpful for us. So we were working out the same set of facts and data on this. So my next question, I guess, for you, Representative Coulter, is if this bill becomes law, is this going to help our local municipalities and projects around the state ensure that the standard is applied ahead of time before the bidding takes place?
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, Representative Schultz. I'm not sure I understand the question.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Referencing the prevailing wage standards, is this going to ensure that prior to a project being sent out for bids, that prevailing wage will be the standard ahead of time prior to the bidding commencing, so that there is certainty amongst contractors and those seeking to do the work?
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would have to defer to the Department of Labor and Industry, but my assumption would be that they could work with local government, and I should specify not all local governments, cities, counties, and school districts, I believe. And I know there are some municipalities, some local jurisdictions that do already require prevailing wage requirements on public projects. I happened to speak with the mayor of Minnetonka about this proposal some time ago, and he mentioned that they already do. So I would assume that that assistance could be provided by the department.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess in the conversations that I've had around this topic, that is something that is exceedingly important. We had additional testimony from Mr. Beshe on the topic, but whomever is deciding to do construction and is working on a big project, we need to have some certainty around our standards. That's why I asked the question. So I'm not sure if there's anyone else in the room that'd be able to provide that information as to whether or not there will be the certainty now with this, if this bill becomes law, on that point. Is there anybody?
I don't see anybody running down here.
Okay.
But I think, as Mr. Beshe said in his testimony, project that was bid, that was in the specs, were in the bid, mm-hmm. that they had to pay prevailing wage on the original bid. So I think Mr. Beshe testified that I'm assuming that would have to be in the packet, in the requirements for the bid.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My next question then for the author is, would this bill, if it became law, would the standard around prevailing wage on these projects supersede decision-making made at the local level by county boards, cities, and school districts?
Representative Coulter.
Without being completely knowledgeable on this particular section of statute, again, my assumption would be yes, because in general, state law supersedes local ordinances.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you. Could you just repeat that one more time? I had a little bit of noise. No offense, Travis.
Sorry. Go ahead, John. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My assumption would be yes. I am, like I said, I do not possess encyclopedic knowledge of this particular section of statute, yeah. But my assumption would be yes.
All right. Very good.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is some concern. There's a lot of different bills moving this session that negatively impact local control, and certainly for us all, we want to really consider the costs that are at play in every different community and the circumstances that may be different. And as you know, I have voted for prevailing wage standards in the past. And yet it's difficult for us to directly decipher where it's right for us from a state policy standard to decide what is best for Marshall. So there are concerns in that regard, and I look forward to getting more of this data that you suggest, Representative Coulter, on this bill, because it does seem to have very, very large impacts to development for schools, cities, and counties in the state.
And Representative Schultz, if it helps you, any prevailing wage is done by highway construction, it's done by region. I believe in vertical construction, it's done county by county that the wage is set at.
Okay.
So it is locally what the local wage is set. It's not the metro area wage.
You know
that's
what?
My, That's been my experience working many years in construction.
Great, Mr. Chair, that's super helpful for us, and you know, to know that those standards are going to be based as locally as possible is super helpful, and we want to benefit our local workers, the people who live in our communities, to see the dollars, especially when there's a state interest at play. Representative Coulter, another question.
Representative Schultz, and we got other people got questions. So Representative
Schultz. Good. Okay. Great.
Go ahead.
Yep. No, my next question would be, do you have any projection, Representative Coulter, as to how much more money this may cost an individual project?
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know folks have cited studies, but there are other studies that do show that prevailing wage requirements, have little to no impact on project costs. And I think... I am aware of several studies that have shown that even on school district projects, on a number of projects. So I don't accept the premise of the question that it does increase costs.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And frankly, you know, this I could have asked the exact same question on the other end. You know, do we have data to suggest that it either raises or lowers the cost? And if so, by which measure? There's a little bit less loaded question for you.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have the studies in front of me. They turned off my JSTOR access when I graduated from college. But there are studies that do exist that show that. I can confirm that.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to ask if the prevailing wage was the same in Minneapolis and Marshall, but you answered that for us.
Thank you. Further questions? Seeing no Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coulter, thank you. See, in your opening talk, you mentioned that the city needs our help with economic development, but this would be contrary to your bill to offering that economic help, because the cost of projects, even if demolition of a plighted area or excavation of an area of land that wanted to be used for park, would only increase the cost of those projects and that economic activity in that community. Wouldn't you agree?
Representative Coulter.
Well, to clarify, I believe what I said is that I think we know that local governments have significant facilities needs. But again, I reject the premise that prevailing wage requirements increase costs. That prevailing wage increase costs is just not accurate. As the chair knows, I serve on the property tax committee. We've had lots of conversations about how local governments are finding it challenging to meet their needs to address the number of issues that they need to fund. And I'm always happy to have that conversation. And, you know, like I said, TIF can be a very, very useful tool. I served on the Bloomington City Council for 5 years. We've had lots of experience with tax increment financing in Bloomington. And I think what this is about is really making sure that workers are protected and respected.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. I think the comment of workers being protected and respected is important, but the insinuation that they're not, if they're not making prevailing wage, or at a merit-based shop. I think that thought has to be, in my opinion, it's not a fair statement. It's painting with a broad brush. In your testimony and that gentleman's testimony, you indicated there was many companies that had wage theft, over $80 million of wage theft with public dollars. I don't know where that money comes from. And if there is a contractor, a developer, that is known with wage theft, Dolly, our commissioner, knows about that, and any city or municipality would have that opportunity to vet the company to ensure that they didn't have any wage theft or any violations against them. But the argument or the statement that you're trying to protect with and respect to the worker, and that only can happen with prevailing wage, I think is not a very fair statement. It could be isolated, certainly, but the thought that prevailing wage won't increase the cost of projects is simply not true. We know that. For example, A cousin of mine, who's about the same age as some of these students out here, he was 23 years old at the time, was working at a shop. I won't mention the shop, but they make coolers for Walmarts and Targets and stuff. Anyway, his first job in that summer intern, it was a prevailing wage job. They had to get prevailing wage. So he got like $47 or $56 an hour, 23 years old. He thought that was wonderful. But his dad, who works at the company, said, well, son, don't count on that every job. This is the first and last one this year, summer that you'll get. So that particular project that they worked on, that cost of that particular project did increase significantly because everybody had to be paid, even a 23-year-old who was only there for a summer intern. So it does increase the cost. And our merit-based shops, which many of us know, family businesses that build construction and build buildings and do parks and stuff, pay their employees very well. I know many in my district very well, pay their employees very well. It's not always prevailing wage. Sometimes it's more, depending on the project. But to insinuate that they're not safe or they're not respected or not paid well and only will do so if your bill passes is simply, I don't think, fair or accurate. And you can certainly prove me wrong, but as our second testifier indicated, that certainly isn't the case in the studies, that the merit-based shops aren't paid well and aren't respected. And the cost will go up. And frankly, I'm opposed to this bill for one project in particular in Delano, where I live. We're going to, the city with the DASA, the Delano Area Hockey Association, is going to build a new ice sheet. And I have a bill in for bonding and for tax exemption to help them. And this will only increase that cost of that project significantly. I'm sure they're going to be very disappointed to hear the extra cost of that project, which is already at $2.5 million, a million more than they thought 2 years ago. So I have grave concerns, and I hope everyone who has any projects in their city has some concerns. And know this, if you don't know, talk to your folks in your district. If you don't think prevailing wage, that only with prevailing wage, a worker is going to be protected, respected, and paid well, well, that's a false premise. And Chair Nelson, you know that. You're in the industry. Not all merit-based shops, that just does not apply to all of them.
And Representative McDonald, I'll have to agree with that statement that there are good merit-based shops out there and there are bad merit-based shops out there. And it's not the vast majority of them. There are people out there doing good work. But they bid every day on projects where prevailing wage is required. And oftentimes they do win those bids. So that it's not this doesn't protect union or non-union and hurt non-union. They bid those jobs and every day they win them, win some and they lose some. Representative Schultz, you had another question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to actually lean in a little bit to what you said a moment as we started the committee today, that we're going to all respect one another around the table. And so, and certainly on our side of the aisle, that's the, you know, we have that premise. And so when we ask questions, it's not to demean anyone around the table. And so I just ask that for all of us that we hear one another when we're asking a question that's you know, certainly relevant to the debate that we're having, the conversation that we're having, to understand the implications of cost, whether positive or negative, on a given bill that we're seeing. So that's just a reminder for us all. I take that for myself when I say that, but I think that's important. The other thing that I wanted to ask Representative Coulter is, I've done my best to try and find in your report that was referenced the concerns, the issues, the issue with the challenges with certain contractors that don't do a good job. And so I guess my next question for you is, to what extent do you think that the Department of Labor and Industry already has the ability to go after these contractors who are bad actors?
Representative Colt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the purpose of this bill is to further empower the Department of Labor and Industry to ensure that they have the tools and resources available under our existing prevailing wage statutes. Again, this bill does not change any of those things. But I, you know, as I mentioned, and I think it's worth repeating, that, you know, ultimately this bill is about transparency and accountability, being able to hold folks accountable where actions they may take involve, in this case, public dollars. And so I think this bill is really just geared toward that, towards ensuring that when a project involves TIF or LIHTC or state sales tax exemptions, that they are then able to further use the tools that they have available currently.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do realize, and thank you to the staff who's been able to get us this report here and helpful for us all, especially since it's the basis for this conversation today. I would just hope that the department does their job to ensure that we're holding to the standards that are already in law in our state and protecting workers and ensuring that we are benefiting our Minnesota workers, whether they work in a merit shop or whether they are a union member. And as we're seeing, as we need to do more building, especially into housing, as you know, this bill specifically references, that we're also keeping in mind the needs of Minnesota taxpayers. So thank you for the dialogue on this bill.
Representative Greenman, you had.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really appreciate this bill, and I think one of the themes of this whole session is that we can't enforce our way out of labor violations. We need to make sure that we are preventing and deterring them to begin with. And so I really appreciate this, looking at all the ways that state is spending resources, that we are using our financial power in order to ensure that before we have to get to a violation, we have prevented that, because it's good for the worker, it's good for the business, it's good for Minnesota. So I really appreciate you doing that, because I think this is a really important place to look as we think about deterring and preventing these this behavior. Thank you.
Representative Coulter, if you want to wrap up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Schultz, I think you set me up nicely, because I think, you know, we are talking about the protection and integrity of public dollars. Tax increment financing is public dollars. It is a form of sort of unrealized public dollars, but public nonetheless. Low-income housing tax credits are public dollars, federally funded public dollars. State sales tax exemptions are a form of public dollars, and that's really what we're talking about here. All of the forms of public investment contained in this bill can be very powerful tools to generate economic development and redevelopment where they are most needed. As I mentioned, I previously served on the Bloomington City Council. I also served on the Bloomington Housing and Redevelopment Authority. I saw lots of examples of developments that otherwise would not have been viable move forward because of TIF and LIHTC. And we certainly know that state sales tax exemptions for local governments can make a big difference. At the end of the day, like I said, these are public dollars, and Minnesotans deserve to know that their public dollars are not subsidizing worker abuse and exploitation. I would appreciate members' support.
And with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 4994, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. The bill's on its way.
Motion. Thank you.
Representative Hansen. The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 3275, and I'll move that House File 3275 be referred to the General Register. Welcome to the committee. Explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You know, it's hard to believe in 2024 we're here talking about child labor. And nearly 100 years ago, on June 2nd, 1924, a child labor constitutional amendment was proposed by Congress. That was actually a very simple and short constitutional amendment. I'm going to read it here. The Congress shall have the power to limit, regulate, and prohibit the labor of persons under 18 years of age. Section 2, the power of the several states is unimpaired by this article, except that the operation of state laws shall be suspended to the extent necessary to give effect to legislation enacted by Congress. 100 years later, we're still dealing with child labor violations. Minnesota was a leader in 1933 when we adopted that constitutional amendment. We ratified the constitutional amendment. What the resolution, House File number 3275, does is it reaffirms our ratification of the child labor amendment. There has not been a state that has adopted the amendment or ratified the amendment since 1937. the issues are still here, and I have with me a testifier to talk a little bit about why the amendment is needed.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bernie Hess with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 1189. I would like to thank Representative Hansen for bringing this forward. Child labor is still going on. The abuse of children still goes on. Department of Labor, U.S., the feds found that there's been a 69% increase of children working illegally since 2018. We don't have to look far. Recently, we had an incident in a food processing plant in southern Minnesota. There's been stuff happening over in Wisconsin in regards to manufacturing, and no state has gone without children being hurt. I would like to focus on what we can do about it. One, let's advance this. Also, let's start being an advocate for all child labor laws. We need to raise awareness. We need to promote safe workplaces. We would love to see more enforcement and more inspectors from Dolly in our state. And we need to support organizations and nonprofits that advocate for this. We also need to educate our own children and their families about what their rights are in the workplace. And we need to engage businesses and corporations. There are some good operators, and these operators need to adopt child labor-free supply chains. Thank you, and I'll stand for any questions.
Any further testifiers that need to speak on this bill? If not, questions of the bill? Questions on the bill, House File 3270, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No question, just I think it's always good, Representative Nelson, to affirm what is important. Oh, and, sorry, Hansen, yes.
We're all sweet.
Commissioner, yeah. So, yeah, sorry, Rick, Representative. Anyway, I was watching the movie Cabrini. Have you seen it? Have you heard about it? It's phenomenal. Cinematically, it's beautiful, wonderful. It's about a nun who was sent here by the Pope, she's an Italian, to help with the Italian immigrants in New York City in 1889. And our rules back then, boy, I turned over to my wife, we were at the theater in Delano, I said, boy, thank God we had politicians or people that cared that had rules and changed our constitution to protect children, because the labor laws, of course, back then were horrendous. And the movie really depicts it very well of how our immigrants were treated when they first came over. And especially children. So I highly recommend going and see the movie. It's inspiring, and you just come back from the movie feeling that, boy, we've really done some beautiful things in America to protect our immigrants and our workers and our children. That's my only piece. It was an opportunity to share and spread the gospel on that movie. And then hear this resolution, Representative Hansen, is before our committee, so it was a coincidence, or God incidence, as my mom used to say, God rest her soul. So thank you for bringing this, and I look forward to supporting this on the House floor and in this committee. Chair.
Representative Hansen, any comment?
Just, you know, the work is never done. The struggle continues. 100 years ago, you know, our predecessors saw this need. We see it now. Reaffirming our ratification is important. I'd ask for your support. And if anybody wants to co-author the resolution, happy to have you join on. So ask for your support.
Any further questions or comments? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 3275 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill's on its way.
Thank you.
Members, we're going to do 4818 next, but some of our testifiers are the Senate in their wisdom. When we put stuff on the bill, they do the same thing. They put the same bills at the same time, so they have to run back and forth. So we're going to do the my bill 3947.
This time. Oh, okay.
And Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Nelson.
We now have your bill, House File 3947, before us.
And I'll move that House File 3947 be laid over for, and members, just so you know, this is going to be the vehicle for our policy bill.
Okay. Called it.
And
go ahead, Chair Nelson, and explain your bill.
And I have a test right here from the Department of Labor and Industry to explain the bill. This is the construction codes and licensing changes, and I'll let him explain, walk through the bill and explain it.
Mr. O'Neill, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sean O'Neill. I'm the Assistant Director of the Construction Codes and Licensing Division at DLI. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3957, the Construction Codes and Licensing Policy and Technical Bill. Sections 1 and 2 of the bill exempts internet continuing education for elevator constructors from the requirement that internet continuing education courses be approved by the International Distance Education Certification Center or the International Association for Continuing Education and Training before the course is submitted for the commissioner's approval. This change would allow the commissioner to approve internet continuing education courses from other organizations so more continuing education can be made available to elevator constructors in Minnesota. Section 3 of the bill fixes an incorrect reference. Section 4 of the bill deletes the reference to the alarm and communications license, as this license type no longer exists, and the continued reference to it in statute has been confusing for some stakeholders. Section 5 of the bill removes an outdated reference to a specific chapter of the National Electrical Code on lines 7.19 and 7.20. And lines 8.19 to 8.24 clarifies the electrical license owner exception, which allows an individual who owns and occupies or will own and occupy a residence upon completion to perform electric work on that residence without a license. Lastly, sections 6 and 7 of the bill update electrical statutes by removing outdated references to specific chapters of the National Electrical Code. The National Electrical Code is updated every 3 years, and part of the reason for these changes is to ensure that the state statute does not reference specific chapters of the code and result in statutes that contain incorrect references when future versions of the code are adopted. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3947.
Thank you. Discussion to the bill. Lead McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, just a question, if on a duplex, is it, I'm just reading 7.7 to 7.12, and maybe I'm not interpreting it correctly, but can a owner of that duplex change a light switch, even though the utility and the electrical is tied to the neighboring behind a wall in the other duplex?
Chair Nelson.
I'll let Mr. O'Neill answer.
Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. In the scenario that you outline, minor replacement work, such as a switch replacement, if it's not on the owner's single-family home that only they are residing in and their family, that work would not be allowed just because of the shared wall situation and the safety hazard that presents. If that duplex owner does not do the wiring correctly, and a fire is started, they're putting that adjoining property and tenant or owner at risk.
Lead McDonald. Any further discussion? Closing remarks, Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, this is updates to the construction codes and licensing statutes, cleaning them up. And again, this will be the vehicle that we'll use for our policy bill that we're going to put together next Tuesday.
Okay. Chair Nelson renews his motion that House File 3947 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members of the committee, since we are waiting on testifiers for the next bill, we'll recess for about 5 minutes.
Are they on their way? So, Chair.
You're just so grateful we took so much extra time on that first bill, right? You got things printed.
We have a lot of more testifiers. Enough time to get to caucus.
We've just had so much.
Oh, no. Oh, no. We have questions galore for you.
So, Representative Byrd.
So, we said, okay. Oh, maybe. Well, just okay. No, we don't have time for stories.
Are you expecting for our like Tuesday to take an extended period of time, or are we just taking one or two bills? Or?
There are basically two bills that will be included in the delete all. And so we hear them. So the
both a finance and a policy?
It's or no a policy.
Just policy.
The Senate, in their infinite wisdom, told us Wednesday that they were doing two bills when they had planned on doing only one bill. So
we didn't have to agree with them. We decided.
Yeah. So they're doing a policy and a finance?
Yes.
We're only doing policy.
Because they're very good at getting
stuff out.
They're
not doing a finance bill now.
So dumb.
They're just doing a policy only bill now. I mean,
do they think there will be finance?
I mean, supplemental budget came out. Targets are still TBD. And I think there's a few things in the governor's supplemental that are not general fund tied, so there'll be some
misclasses of finance bill, even though it probably won't add to the budget because it has penalties. And that will have to go as a finance bill, even if it doesn't have a fiscal.
How are you doing on that bill?
Great.
Yeah.
It's in taxes next week. There's still, I think there's still a few. It's also going to be in there. With the, what's going on in the Senate, I'm just putting everything in every.
Oh, he's at his cap.
Good memory. That was 2 weeks
I capped him on a amount of bills he can do. Not me, though. I've had no clue.
Yeah.
He's on one with me and Semicub and Knorr.
Which one? I signed on to a list like
yeah. It's a worker safe. It's a worker safety bill.
Put a new tie on?
Yeah.
It's the.
Did you guys vote for that?
You don't wear purple there.
I was the first Republican.
No, I couldn't.
I was the first author on that bill on the Republican side.
You were the first author?
Yeah.
We've been trying to pass that.
Rhinos.
Yeah. I voted for it.
Is that like a little
my union guys are just like, we don't care.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, it affects just like the status you bought Marathon and
no, I have one of my 49ers. Very like he loves being down there, very involved and stuff. And he works down there. He's just like whatever.
Bernie.
They were like. I think it was my first session with the Senate. We sent it over.
And you don't know Bernie Hess?
Public or they weren't gonna hear it in the Carla Bingham.
I don't think you need the labor. I don't think you need the labor CLA anymore.
They opened up the vote and there were
excuse myself.
Bunch of Republicans.
I only show your face in the grocery store anymore.
This would be my cue to come on.
I see. 39-35.
Take a look at it.
Your bill?
Yeah. And talk to Semicub. He likes it.
Minorities allowed to interview Jill?
Well, if your last name is Myers, not.
But you can introduce all the bills you want.
No, ask Tom.
You're right.
Okay.
You've got two Dem sponsors on this.
Yeah. And then you.
Yeah.
What's the bill number?
3935.
You guys want a mic
turn? Yes. No problem.
But hopefully not recording.
That I don't know.
No, House TV is kind of a way to like
something more
music.
Interesting. Is this a criminal? Who's a criminal?
Who's a criminal?
Is this a criminal statute?
It's just like when Heather had that crime bill. Oh no, it was the cyber. It was the Liz Lee had the crime bill.
They are protected.
The only bills I've ever heard go to public safety were all really good. They're just plain.
They're their own government.
You want to be on the tax committee?
Yeah, and it's like when I presented my first bill there, it was like most fun. Like they don't really know enough about it, so they have like 30,000.
Emma wants something that I want.
Does usually everybody want to be on taxes or nobody wants to be on it? It seems like it depends on.
I think that there's some people who are on the tax.
Yeah. I know some people get frustrated because they never vote on it, other than the fine tax.
Also, it's like
voting.
Yeah.
It's like both of those are like the slushiest committee.
Yeah.
Voting is like field trip. But taxes, like, I'm. Very undemocratic.
I think after we.
The tax committee?
We were talking.
Yeah.
Not the committee, but like the everything from the tax. Yeah.
Oh,
it's
okay.
We are making spending this way.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if the tax expenditure is such an expenditure revenue.
And you lump it all together.
And like, if some of that stuff, that
I just roll it into it.
They say the same thing about us.
A lot of
testimony,
a lot of stuff.
Well, and then in the end, so many things get thrown.
And then that's
why we are all here.
But as a matter of,
I had an opportunity to. My senator passed to run in that special election. I chose to stay here.
Well done.
Although
they try to get into that, right?
4-year term.
Yeah,
I didn't think that. With half the members, you got twice as much work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, did you say you presented in tax committee and that was fun?
It was really fun. I had a lunch. It was the one-page bill on acquiring corporations over $250 million.
Oh, the disclosure, right?
Yeah. So fun.
Okay, but not because Greg Davids was nice and agreed with
it. No, Greg Davids asked a question to everybody, which is, what is. Who decides about fair share?
Yeah.
Voters do. We're in a democracy. Our constituents are the ones who should be deciding what is fair share.
I guess.
I was very fortunate.
Here we go.
I'm like, hey, I'm just giving you a heads up.
You're already disclosed.
Like, I got constituents that come, you know.
I'll send you the cup because let down
opposition.
Everybody coming? Yeah.
It's very in
the hearing. Okay, I did see that. Oh, yes. That's right. Shouldn't be a lot of.
But it's just like, stuff like that, like, it is.
And it seems like the tax committee, when Mark Hort was chair, and even since then, they take some of the procedural stuff more seriously. Like the conference committee actually meets and adopts section by section. Everybody else just comes in one fell swoop once they have an agreement. But they met every day.
We did that in takeout.
Yeah.
We were just hoping because part of it was like we didn't agree.
Yeah.
But also, I don't know if that's also something that we're doing.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the committee or if that's.
Yeah. I think it was a Paul Merkel one, too.
What are we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to call the meeting back to order. If the members want to get back to their seats. And the next bill we have on our agenda is House File 4018. And Representative, this will be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Berg, do you want to make your motion?
Yes, thank you, Chair Nelson. I would like to move the A2, the author's amendment, to get the bill.
First move the bill.
Okay. I move House File 4818 before the committee.
And then you have one amendment that's yours?
I do. And I'd like to move A2, the author's amendment, which deletes the section authorizing civil actions for violations. Also changes from including MAC employees in the bill to excluding them. These changes will get the bill in the order I prefer.
So the A2 amendment has been moved to put the bill in the order the author would like. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye. Opposed? The ayes have it? Or the aye has it?
Thank you.
With that, members, Representative Berg, if you want to explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Our Minneapolis-St. Paul service workers are a workforce that is most often powered by Black, brown, and immigrant workers. They keep our airport safe, clean, and running through their jobs as cleaners, baggage handlers, security officers, wheelchair attendants, concession workers, passenger service agents, ramp and cargo workers. They play a critical role in keeping MSP's elite status as one of our nation's best airports. They also play a critical role in me being able to perform my job. Without them, my job becomes harder and every passenger's experience becomes worse. We believe in an efficient 21st century national air travel system starts with an empowered, well-paid, trained, and stable workforce within our airports. Airlines and subcontractors must invest in the workers who do difficult, yet often disregarded work. Workers at the airport have won some big steps over the last decade, including setting a $15 minimum wage and winning paid sick days. However, to make sure these specific workers have what they need and we can make sure enough people can make ends meet, we need to step up, as do the employers at the MAC. Moreover, there is a clear and acute problem with respect to health care coverage for workers at the airport. A survey that was conducted by the MAC also found that only 30% of employees at the airport accept employer-provided health insurance. This means that according to these workers, they are uninsured at a rate of 3 times higher than the national average. SEIU Local 26 data shows that for their folks that do have health insurance, over 80% say they get their health care through the government. Congress has invested billions in our airports and travel and air travel infrastructure. This is a heavily subsidized industry, yet here at MSP, our low-wage workers still have limited access to affordable health care. So not only are taxpayers subsidizing this industry directly, but airport workers that make this work possible are not reaping any of the benefits and are forced into subsidized health care. Our intent to pass the MSP Healthcare Equity Act will require an employer to provide an employee who enrolls in an employer-provided health benefits plan the minimum fringe benefits as determined by the SCA, currently $4.98 for passenger-related service, ramp and aircraft services, in-terminal and passenger handling, in-flight catering and cleaning and concession workers. Allow for the Metropolitan Airport Commission to enforce implementation and promote conditions for a strong and stable workforce at MSP. I ask and urge you to support this legislation. Our workers deserve respect and dignified work. Our workers deserve access to affordable health care. They have been patient enough. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe I have testifiers.
And I have a list of testifiers here. And before I call the testifiers up, try and limit yourself, and if you don't, I will cut you off to 3 minutes so that we can get through everybody. This bill is being laid over for possible inclusion. We want to be able to get to questions from members. First person I have on my list is Tedros Haptis, and I know I butchered that last name. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. And the next person I have is Fudama Harishi. So if you can be ready to come on down. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi. My name is Tedros Haptis, unit member of Local 17. I'm a driver at LSD Skyshift. I have worked at LSD Skyshift at the MSP airport for nearly 14 years. I was an essential worker who worked during the entire COVID crisis to right now. I must work overtime every week to survive. The cost of food and everything is rising fast as my wage. Our company insurance is expensive and I cannot afford it. So I don't have healthcare insurance, me and my family, my three children, that means. Because the company that the insurance that offers us is very expensive and we can't afford it. So I'm asking you to do everything you can to make health insurance more affordable at MSP. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. Madama Harishi, and then I have Osman Sheikh.
Hi.
Mr. Chair, we have an interpreter.
Okay, if you can. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed. And if you want to identify yourself, also the interpreter.
Hi, my name is Fatima Hersey. I'm working for the airport. Company is constructed.
Chair members, my name is Abdusamad Aden, and I'm an interpreter. Hello, my name is Fatima Hersey, and I have worked at the airport since 2021. When I moved here from Seattle, I am a wheelchair agent who makes sure passengers can get to their flights. I love my job, and moving around and helping people is good for me, but my health is hurting because I don't have good health care.
mana awoodi inaan kambanigan hadda aan u shaqeeyo $200 aan shaqo inaan dhigo marka caawinadaan u baahanahay inaan laga caawiyo kambaniga hore u shaqeey jiray $35 waxaan uga soo tagay caafimaadkayga dartiisa because indhaha layga duraa dhaqtarkayga yiri iska dhaaf shaqadan saana ugu soo badashtay dhibkaanan hadda iga haysta caafimaad darada 3 bilood oo daawo ah.
In my previous job as a janitor, I paid $35 for health care. I was able to get my doctor and medicine, but I had to leave that job because I have issues with my eyes. My doctor told me I had to quit my old job. In January, I went to the doctor and didn't have insurance. My doctor wanted to help me, but they couldn't because I don't have health insurance. This has caused me a lot of stress. I'm scared I'll get sick and have no money. It's wrong people who work at this airport that wins all these awards have to worry about affording to care for ourselves. I'm just starting to pay $200 per month for insurance plus a copay plus medicine, but I only make a little over $15 an hour. I'm diabetic and I take medicine for that. I have to take medicine for my cholesterol. I use so many medications every single day. I have to take medicine to stop pressure and pain in my eyes. I don't sleep well because I'm scared. I don't want to lose my eyes or my health. Because of high healthcare costs, I have to spend most of my paycheck to go to Walgreens to get medicine. And even then, I only get half my medicine. We've tried to solve this issue with our employer and the airport, but they won't act. Please help us make sure we can afford healthcare so people like me who make our airport run aren't laying awake at night worrying about if we can go to the doctor. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Osman Sheikh, and then next I have Jeff Davidman. Welcome to the committee. Proceed with your testimony.
My name is Osman Sheikh, and I have worked at the airport since 2015 as a wheelchair and cleaners. I am broad member of ICU Local 26. I am part of group 1,000 SSU member at MSP Airport who do bachelor service like cabin cleaning, car driving, wheelchair agent, and more. We are majority immigrant and people of color, and our work helps the MSP win all the awards it does as one of the best airports in the country. During the hardest month of COVID, we showed up and worked without the protection we needed. Make sure the airport survived at great risk to our own health. Yet, here we are today fighting for affordable health care. We have won higher wages and basic days through our fights. We are currently struggling to make sure the frontline workers at MSP have affordable health care. A recent survey of hundreds of airport workers found 82% reported they receive health insurance through the government, but now many are losing that affordable coverage because wages have gone up. That survey found that only 15% report that they received health insurance from their employer, which is very expensive. We want our employers to at the beginning table to tell them about this crisis. And guess what they said to us? No. We went to the airport commission that runs the airport and told them about this crisis. And guess what they said to us? No. That's why we need you to act. We keep the airport running, but we are going to lose workers if this doesn't change. And that would hurt the airport we all love. Please stand up for the workers who make MSP run and ensure that affordable health care is something that we all have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Jeff Davidman. And next I have Malay Shaw. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Yeah, in the interest of time, I will, Jeff will not testify.
Okay, so you're Nalay, okay.
Yeah, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nalay Shah with Delta Airlines. I appreciate the chance to testify about House File 4818, as this covers everyone at the airport, including employees of Delta Airlines. I've been at Delta Airlines for 3 years, where I lead our health and wellness benefits, health analytics, and innovation teams. Before that, I was a professor and chair of the Division of Healthcare Delivery Research at Mayo Clinic. 3 years ago, Delta Airlines became the first airline to hire a chief health officer when Delta hired Dr. Henry Ting, a cardiologist. Previously, Dr. Ting was the chief value officer of Mayo Clinic. Our one-of-a-kind team assembled by Dr. Ting, a world-class healthcare experts team, has done surveys, focus groups, one-on-one qualitative interviews with employees to better understand the needs of our employees when it comes to health and healthcare. One of our realizations is that there isn't one plan fits all that works for 100,000 employees. Therefore, we have put together a variety of different choices that employees can choose from that best fits their needs and their families' needs. Through our qualitative interviews, we were able to get meaningful feedback to identify key concerns related to health, healthcare, and benefits from our employees. Since receiving this feedback, we have introduced many new programs. One such program provides high-quality mental health care, including 12 free visits a year for all our employees and their family members. More importantly, we wanted to make sure to address the access for employees and their families, not just coverage. On average, employees are now able to get an appointment with a provider within 1.2 days. Further, the program allows users to find therapists that are concordant based on sex, race, age, or LGBTQ status. The use of this service, which is not part of the health plan, was greater in the first 3 months than what we would have anticipated in a full year. We provide these options because we engage directly with our employees to hear their concerns and provide options that work best for them. This is a continuous and ongoing process. I share all of this background with you to highlight the fact that At Delta, we offer our employees world-class health care benefits, and we don't come anywhere close to meeting the requirements of House File 4818. In fact, initial calculations show that even with all the benefits we provide for our employees, our richest plan that employees could choose would still fall more than 25% short of the $4.98 per hour requirement supplement as prescribed by this legislation. If we would be required to comply with this legislation, it would add millions of dollars in additional costs, and I can tell you, based on the work that we have done over the past few years, would not provide better care for our employees. In fact, it could diminish the services that we provide our employees, as we would have to change the benefits to meet the needs of what the state of Minnesota is prescribing as important versus what our employees have said is important, based on the hundreds of interviews and conversations we've had directly with our employees over the past few years. I appreciate the opportunity to testify and can address any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next person on my list is Jonathan Weinhagen. And then after that, I have Carrie Warren.
Good afternoon, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Weinhagen. I'm the president and CEO of the Minneapolis Regional Chamber, and I'm here to speak in opposition to House File 4818. As the largest regional chamber of commerce in the state of Minnesota, representing businesses across the Minneapolis-St. Paul region, we know the importance of having a robust and diverse workforce. We may be unique here as a testifier where we represent some of the very largest and smallest employers who would be impacted by this proposal. As we continue to grapple with an extraordinarily tight labor market, inflation, and the reality that we're still continuing to emerge from a global pandemic, which hit the travel industry as much as anyone else, remaining competitive is critical at this time. While the Chamber strongly supports providing employees benefits for their health and wellness, we have significant concerns with this proposal as written, particularly the burdens this would place on small businesses who are already struggling financially. Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport was recently recognized as one of the top airports in North America, an accolade they've received 7 of the last 8 years. This award is based on passenger feedback from over 400 airports in 95 countries. A major point of recognition is the dining and shopping experiences that folks recognize at the airport. Cultivating a vibrant, diverse business environment is essential to the health of the MSP region, and a world-class airport is a critical part of that activity. Ensuring that small businesses, many who participate in the airport concessionaire's disadvantaged business enterprise program, an industry-leading gold standard, is part of MSP's recognized success. We should work to continue to ensure that those businesses and all businesses who operate at the airport are not harmed by additional mandates like the one proposed here today. I want to thank you all for your time and the work that you're doing here. The Chamber urges policymakers to continue to work with all of the stakeholders to find a path that continues to allow individuals and businesses to thrive across the MSP region and the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Carrie Warren, and next I have Mitchell Killian. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie Warren, and I am the Executive Director of MSP Small Business Concessions Alliance, or MSBCA. MSBCA is a group of small women and minority-owned and operated and federally certified as airport concessionaires disadvantaged business and enterprises that operate at MSP. MSBCA members are restaurant and retail businesses who together enhance the experience of MSP travelers, create vital jobs, and produce revenue for the airport community. The MSBCA respectfully opposes House File 4818. The concessions business at MSP is unique, and our members are among the most heavily regulated businesses in the state. In fact, MAC already oversees our health care and benefit offerings through both our leases and as a part of the RFP process that uses the McNamara O'Hara Service Contract Act standard UC referenced in this bill. Additionally, the MAC, our landlord, caps the prices we can charge our customers, preventing us from recouping the additional costs that would come were House File 4818 to be enacted. Over the last few years, the MAC has proactively studied healthcare offerings by our members and decided a change in their current policies wasn't needed. We hope this serves as an assurance that our employees already have access to the affordable, quality health care the bill seeks. Thank you.
Thank you. Mitchell Killian and then Jill Sims. Again, we've got keep it as short as you can. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chairman Nelson. Mitch Killian with the Metropolitan Airports Commission. Thanks for the chance to comment. One thing I want to really get straight right away is that there's no doubt about the success of MSP is because of the employees that are out there. We have over 20,000 badged employees, and that doesn't count the people that are outside the fence but that are still on airport property. And the awards that we win, Best Airport North America, Most Efficient Airport, Most On-Time Airport, that's all due to the employees, so we all can agree to that. The one disagreement we have is that, actually, we also can agree that healthcare costs in Minnesota and for employees is a tough issue these days and continues to rise and continues to be a real debate that probably needs to occur. But where we disagree is that there should be a policy that singles out airport employees and provides a benefit that the state establishes in this bill and then actually makes MAC to be the regulator of that benefit in the future. So this bill actually singles out the employees and employers at the airport and applies this new benefit. It would apply to places like the Holiday gas station that's on airport property that sits right next to Bloomington. It applies to our hotel, but doesn't apply to the hotel across the river in Eagan. It applies to the doggy daycare center that's on the north side of the airport near the 28th Avenue, but it doesn't apply to the doggy daycare centers that are in South Minneapolis. So these employers and employees would have a special state benefit that is directed to them. I don't know if you know, but when we go out for businesses like those that I just mentioned and others, we do requests for proposals, and we put out issues and we look for different businesses that want to invest. We're a big economic development company really out there in many ways. And so when we're putting those proposals out, if we have these type of state policies laid on top of us, it's going to make it more challenging to get investors and who wants to come in and what does that relationship look like. On top of that, I don't know if you know, but 40% of our passengers at MSP are connecting. So there's 40% of those passengers that are just connecting through MSP, and that's what provides all of us with the great air service and the frequencies that we have today. When we are out working to retain that air service, when you have policies like this, it can affect that. Airlines have choices about where they want to connect passengers through, and they definitely can change those business models. I'll give you one story about Aer Lingus. When we went out to solicit Aer Lingus before the pandemic, there were 6 to 9 airports that were on their list. They had enough airplanes to add one new location. We pitched things like the types of businesses that are here, how many Irish businesses are here, how many are there, what type of sports might come back and forth, demographics of the community on incomes, education. But then you get into airport specifics. What's the taxiway from the, what's the time to taxi from the runways to the gates? What's the relationship of the jetways with the airport and the tenants? And they look closely at local airport policies like this, whether it be an airport policy or policies that are state implemented. There are, we got Aer Lingus at that time, and we still have them coming out of the pandemic, but there are 5 or 6 airports that didn't get them, and they still remain without them. So when we're out doing our pitch, they look close at these policies and what's going on, and it can affect us. Remember, we just got Lufthansa in a very competitive market. Each one of the, when we got Seoul with Delta, those are very competitive situations when we're out pitching it, and I just want to make sure the committee knows these types of policies can affect that. I want to make sure that the committee understands we have very friendly labor policies out there. I think the chairman knows because he's been involved with some of the things over the years, but we have great relationships with our own employees and their unions. We have project labor agreement policies, labor peace agreements, worker retention. We have prevailing wage. We have very aggressive labor-friendly policies at the airport. We estimate that 70% of the workforce, and that's a low estimate, are represented by unions. And those unions have negotiated some level of health care. Sometimes it's just one level, one policy, but others have multiple policies that are available. So the unions have. The collective bargaining process for those unions have negotiated a variety of plans. And it, just in case the committee doesn't know, some of our concessionaires at the airport today and some of the airline service providers are currently in collective bargaining. The Metropolitan Airports Commission respects that collective bargaining process, and we hope the two parties come to agreement soon. If I can, I'd like to make one more point about the regulation piece. So the Metropolitan Airports Commission was established to run and own and operate airports. It goes back to the 1940s. I would say to you, by most standards, it's recognized as a great system, and very forward legislators that thought of this process of having us run airports as an airport authority has worked out very well. We operate a lot like a city does. We have public safety with police and fire that are responsible to us. We have a public works department that takes care of like the field maintenance and those pieces. No problem. But this will add a different level of what we are expected to do. If you read in the bill, it's going to have audit, investigation, enforcement, things like that that we're going to now be responsible for. So if you think of your own cities and their HR departments and having to regulate all your employers, in our case, 700 employers, 700 businesses at the airport that we're now going to be responsible for regulating this new benefit, I just would have you think about your own cities and counties and could they do it and should they do it? And I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Jill Sims. And next I have Todd Hill. And welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members. My name is Jill Sims. I'm the Director of Government Relations at Hospitality Minnesota. We appreciate the opportunity to offer our perspective on House File 4818 and come to you today respectfully in opposition. Hospitality Minnesota is proud to serve passengers, whether they're coming home, visiting, or just stopping through from the moment they land at MSP to wherever their journey may take them. We are proud to have a world-class airport, and our members at MSP and beyond seek to deliver a high level of service to each and every guest. One of the greatest challenges facing the hospitality industry right now is financial recovery. Our airport operators are no exception. As Twin Cities area restaurants and hotels have had a slow and fragile recovery over the past few years. The hospitality industry already operates on extremely thin margins of 2 to 5%. So our road ahead looks very challenging. And when you factor in additional costs, which bills like this will add, it gets even more challenging. House File 4818 does not account for the challenges our business face, nor does it account for the unique parameters our MSP operators do business under. For example, the MAC caps prices at which customers can be charged. So how does an operator make up the cost of the benefit differential? Additionally, how does an operator account for the wage differential between locations outside of MSP? With an already strained workforce, do their other locations lose employees to those who only want to work at their MSP location? Additionally, this bill seems to go beyond the bounds of the airport itself and includes all businesses on the MAC airport property, like the hotel site that was mentioned or the Holiday gas station. We believe governance issues at MSP reside within the MAC and not the legislature. Our operators value their employees and know that they are on the forefront of ensuring MSP maintains its status as a world-class international airport by showing each and every passenger world-class hospitality. This legislation would change the dynamics of an industry that is desperately trying to recover. Respectfully, we ask that you oppose House File 4818. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Todd Hill. And then the last person I have is Helu Mulgeta, I guess is how it's said. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and members of the House Labor Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some brief comments today regarding House File 4818. For the record, my name is Todd Hill with Hill Capital Strategies, and I'm here on behalf of my client, Enterprise Rent-A-Car, and testifying in opposition to this proposal. As background, Enterprise was founded in 1957 by Jack Taylor with seven cars. In St. Louis, Enterprise is named after the USS Enterprise, the aircraft carrier that he served on. Today, it is the largest rental car company in the world with more than 8,000 worldwide locations and more than 90,000 employees. Enterprise employs more than 800 Minnesotans at roughly 50 locations across the state. The company, which started as your hometown rental car company, has grown to a brand now offered at airports all around the world. The company owns and operates Enterprise, National, and Alamo at MSP. In addition to our airport business, we also have hometown rentals. We also manage fleet services. We have truck rentals, car sales, car sharing. We manage van pools, and we even offer a rental subscription service. At MSP, Enterprise will employ between 300 and 400 employees, depending upon the season. Some of our employees at MSP may also share time at other locations around the Twin Cities or be designated to multiple locations. We have both salaried and hourly employees working at Enterprise and for our other brands. As a worldwide company, Enterprise takes great pride in the opportunities for employee development, training, and promotion from within. Along with the benefits offered to their employees, and I had a lot of firsthand experience, my daughter started at Enterprise in their management training program when she graduated from college. I know how hard she worked at NSP, and I know how committed Enterprise is to promoting people from within. Every executive that I've worked with as a lobbyist for this company over 30 years started out in the same spot, in the management training program, doing whatever job was necessary. For a company in an industry which was devastated by COVID and only now beginning to get back to pre-pandemic levels of employees, vehicles, and customers, this bill would have a significant financial impact on Enterprise operations at NSP. Based upon a quick analysis of the hours worked and employee headcount at the airport in February of 2024, this bill would cost Enterprise more than $2.1 million to implement. This projection is likely very much on the low side, as February is typically the slowest month of the year with the lowest number of hours and the lowest headcount. This cost would grow throughout the year as hours are added and headcount is increased. Employees at Enterprise have access already to incredible benefits. Currently, a benefit-eligible employee seeking single coverage will pay $121 a month, with Enterprise covering the remaining 84% of the total premium. This bill doesn't appear to take into account what we're already doing. This bill will also have a significant impact on our customers. The only way to recover these costs will be our rate by raising rental car taxes.
You want to get to a conclusion?
Yep, I am, sir. Right now at the airport, a customer pays nearly 34% on top of the rental rate in fees and taxes that almost all go to the state of Minnesota or to MSP. We urge you to oppose this legislation because of the cost we'll have on our customers and the impact on our business. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. And the last testifier I have is Halu. And if you want to state your name for the record, and then you can proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman and committee members. My name is Halu Mungeta. I am the member of United Local 7. I am working at the LSE Jeans Scholarship for about 14 years. I was an essential worker who worked during the entire COVID crisis. Right now, I must work overtime every week to survive. The cost of food and everything are rising faster than wage, than my wage. For my single health insurance, I pay over for $300 MS. My wife and kids get their insurance through the state because I cannot afford the insurance LSE over me. For me, if I had an extra 300 MS, I will be able to buy food for my family and I don't have to work so much overtime because I cannot get time to spend time with my kids. I used to work more overtime to cover my expenses, like house rent, gas, and everything is goes higher this time. That I cannot afford it. Even house rent is go rise this time. Then, because of that, I cannot pay my house rent this time. If it continues like that, maybe I can be. My chance is to be homeless. Because of that, I'm asking you to do everything you can to make health insurance more affordable for the MSP workers. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. And members, seeing as how we're getting close to the end of our time here today, and we got session coming up, this bill's being laid over. I'm going to lay this bill over for a future meeting. For now, we'll take up the amendments then. If you want to put them back in your packet, we'll hang on to them in your packets, and we can get to discussion in that in the future meeting and go from there. So, because we'll need to get to caucus and we need to get to session. So, members, with that, for right now, I'm going to lay this bill over. Probably when we get back from the break, the first meeting back from the break, we'll take this bill back up. With that, members, Representative McDonald?
Mr. Chairman, are you taking up the amendments now, or is it everything
being laid? We'll do the amendments when we come back from break.
When we come back for break. Okay. Question, now this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion?
This is going to be laid over. We don't know if it's going to be possibly included or not.
I hope not. But question for the author, though, Representative Byrd. Is that your desire to lay this over, or move it to state gov as you committed to Representative Nash on the House floor last Thursday?
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative McDonald. It is my desire to adjourn from this meeting and take it up next week. We all know that bills are held at the discretion of the chair, and I believe Chair Cleghorn and Lead Nash had quite a conversation about it.
Representative McDonald.
So, Mr. Chairman, so we have to, you said we'd probably run a little bit late. That would be okay, but you're changing your decision.
I'm looking at the amendments. I'm looking at the amount of time we have left, and we'll do the amendments. Like I said, probably won't be till after break. April 2nd, I think, is our next meeting after, first meeting after the break.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Well, we'll honor that as well, but just in case I can't make that meeting, can you do it the next time then? I got a lot of good amendments.
Anyway, you've got good amendments here that we can discuss, but with that, members, like I said, put the stuff back in your packets and put it in the save file so we don't have to reprint all this stuff, and so that we have it for the next meeting when we get back. With that, members, this bill is laid over for future consideration. With that, members, we are adjourned.
I got it online.